So I've called the talk today, Reimagining Our Connection to Country. And obviously we've been through a really shocking few months recently. A lot of heartbreak, the loss of life and livelihoods and ecological systems. And we've all, you know, I think it's really shaking us all up as a country and as individuals. And I guess for a lot of us, it's how do we respond to something like that, you know, in the short term, but also perhaps moving forward. And one of the things I've noticed for myself is I've been quite disturbed by a lot of the public discourse that's been happening as well. Some of the outright lies that have been told, but also that sort of blaming, shifting the blame, and that language of scapegoating and pointing the finger, and often quite aggressive. And also people not taking any responsibility at all, you know, just saying, oh, it's something else all entirely. And when you think about who is actually responsible for the situation we find ourselves in, the reality is we're actually all responsible. You know, even if we live a life that's got some environmental awareness and we try not to cause too much harm, we're still part of the society which is allowing the global warming to happen. And this is not saying that people who are in power, either politically or they have a lot of money or other resources, or perhaps a public profile like media, you know, we do need to hold them to account and, you know, take responsibility for what they can do. But we also need to hold ourselves to account and take responsibility for what we can do. And so I noticed for myself, you know, it's quite easy to get caught up in the sense of blaming and looking for someone to blame. And of course, that's not helpful. Just looking outside, it's also looking within. In Buddhist perspective, the second noble truth is, dukkha or unsatisfactory nature of existence is caused by greed, hatred, and ignorance. And when we look inside us, we can all notice those tendencies, that desire for a comfortable life, aversion to what's uncomfortable or unpleasant. And also perhaps a sense of apathy or, you know, not just wanting to see things as they are sometimes. So another Buddhist way we can look at that is what is actually this mindset that we bring into the situation. And there's been some very interesting research by a researcher called Carol Dweck. She's actually written a book called Mindset. And she's done a lot of studies into, you know, the mindset that we have. And she identifies two main forms that we have. And some people are more in one or the other, but we're all on a continuum and we all can move from one to the other. So one is called the fixed mindset. And that is very much about having a sense of this is who I am, this is my identity, and then having to continually prove that's who I am. And the other mindset is called a growth mindset. That's much more open and fluid and saying, you know, these are some of the things that I'm interested in learning, and there's much more a passion for learning new things and less a hunger for approval. So the fixed mindset is very much, you know, I'm smart and I want everyone to keep telling me that I'm smart. Whereas the growth mindset might be, you know, I would like to learn more about this, and I'm curious and open to sort of learning and developing as we go along. And one of the interesting things about her research is that it's quite easy to trigger one of those mindsets in people just by simple things like about what kind of feedback you give them. So for instance, if people are doing like a test in a study type situation, and then they're told, oh, you're very smart, you did well, then, you know, that immediately creates a fixed mindset and you just have to keep proving that you're smart. Whereas if you say to them, oh, you've worked really hard, you know, then that triggers a growth mindset and encourages people and then when they get harder tasks, the ones who've got the fixed mindset happening, they're not really wanting to try that much either, just stay with what's safe, because that's going to keep proving what their identity is. Where the growth mindset is much more likely to take risks and say, okay, if I make mistakes, that's okay, because I'll keep learning from that. And the other interesting one that she found, which I found very interesting in the current circumstances, is that when the fixed mindset were asked to take on something that's too difficult and they didn't do so well, they actually would lie about it. They'd rather lie about the outcome than admit that they hadn't quite managed it. And so I guess for me, it's looking at how can we, in a Buddhist context, cultivate conversations in our own lives and in the public discourse that encourages a growth mindset in everyone, that doesn't push people into a fixed mindset, because we all need to take risks and really confront things and have that sense of, you know, we don't have any guarantees that something will work, but we do need to take some risks and try things and develop that growth mindset. And Buddhism as a, you know, as a practice does encourage the growth mindset, because one of the things we do a lot is meditation. And a growth mindset is sort of that willingness to keep practicing and to sort of have that ongoing practice. And the Pali word for meditation is bhavana, which literally means to cultivate. So it's a sense of continually cultivating sort of positive qualities in our lives, rather than just assuming, oh, you're good or you're bad, you've got those qualities. And of course, there's plenty of fixed mindsets in Buddhism as well. But certainly in ordinary minds, then Joko Beck and Jeff Dawson, you know, keep saying the challenges of life, that's the grist of practice, that's where the practice really happens, and that's where we can really engage in our practice. So it's really being very open to challenges and practicing with them. So basically, another way of looking at this, again in the Zen tradition, is how we talk, the language that we use. And we have the precepts in Zen, and one of them is not to lie. But Diane Rizzetto, who's also a teacher in Ordinary Mind Zen, she wrote a book on Zen precepts, and it's called Waking Up to What You Do, a Zen Practice for Meeting Every Situation with Intelligence and Compassion, which sounds like a pretty good book to be looking at the moment. And we have actually, as a group, looked at that a few years ago and worked through it for a year. But the way she describes this precept of do not tell lies is, I take up the way of speaking of others with openness and possibility. And to me, that just seems so important at the moment, that when we converse either with ourselves or with others, or with, you know, get engaged in some of them open, like Facebook or some of the other dialogues, that we keep leaving that possibility, have a sense of openness in the dialogue and a sense of possibility for others as well. So how do we communicate so the conversation encourages a sense of growth mindset and that possibility, rather than condemnation and scapegoating? A mindset, I think, is also key about our relationship with nature. And for myself, the key experience was when I was around 12 and I learned about acid rain in Germany and that it was killing the forest, which it was. And I just remember thinking, there's just something really wrong with the system and the society that can allow this to happen. So it was this real sense of something is really wrong here. And really everything from then has kind of been within that context of, you know, what is wrong here with the way things are, and what can I do about it, and how can I engage with that? And one of the things that I learned is how to recognize the four stages of a dying tree, a tree that was dying from acid rain. Because if you went into a German forest at the time, you know, it's a forest, and you don't look too closely, go, oh yeah, it's a forest here. But when you look more closely, you could say, oh, that's dead tree. None of the trees are really healthy, and a lot in stage one, but quite a few in stage three, and you could really recognize it. And that's one of the things we also do with meditation in the Buddhist practice, is, you know, we can sort of be like, yeah, we're sort of okay, like none of us are probably evil. But when you actually take the time to meditate and really observe what's going on in your mind, you actually start to notice quite a few things, and you go, ah, yeah, there's quite a tendency to grasping there's quite a tendency of avoiding, had a tendency of fantasizing. So we can, by noticing what's going on, observe much more clearly what's happening. And so over the years, my trainees, I was involved in Rainforest Action Group, and that was a very different way of looking at our relationship with nature. And I've also been running mindfulness nature retreats, and again, it's about going into the bush and looking at, you know, what is actually happening here and what is our relationship to the plants. And I've also been able to work in Aboriginal health and learn a little bit from, you know, the Aboriginal way of looking at our environment and the connection to country. And it's, for me, a lot of it is what can be helpful is that reimagination. So how do we imagine our relationship to ourselves and to nature a bit differently? And we also do that in Buddhism. So we have the image of the Buddha, and we have a sense of, you know, things aren't quite how they should be. That's why we do all this meditation. There's an image of the Buddha, calm, equanimity, gentle smile, compassion, you know, and so we have that sense of this is an image that we carry, that we aspire to. And that's what the practice is about, that sense of I can imagine something different. I don't have to just keep going the way I am. I can imagine there's actually potential for something different here. And we can also do that with imagining a different relationship to the natural environment. So I've been doing a lot of reading and thinking. And one of the best things I read recently was an article on online called The Importance of Remembering Our Connection to Country. And it was written by Leandra Martiniello, and she's a woman with a Arrernte heritage and living near Darebin Creek. And she said, you know, again, in response to these bushfires, what she feels is like, well, how do we respond to this? This article is written for young people in particular. And she says it's really about healing our connection with country for both Indigenous people and for non-Indigenous people. And connecting with the spirit of the land. And even when there's concrete and parking, there's still the land underneath and actually teeming with life. And so I found the way she wrote it really beautiful. So I'm actually just going to read quite a bit of her essay, because to me it really encapsulates so beautifully what, you know, what might be helpful for us in this situation. So she says, I live close to the Darebin Creek, and I'm able to find sanctuary there almost daily. Hidden amidst cars and railway lines, there are secret wetlands that support the creek on its journey to confluence with the Burrung. These wetlands are home to birds, turtles, and snakes. To remember over and over again the sacredness of this place, I need only hear the dance between wind and tree, or to contemplate the ancient pathway of Maribyrnong, Mary, or Burrung. We may have paved over creeks and turned the riverbanks to concrete, but water has always made its sacred pilgrimage along these pathways, and it will continue to do so long after we're gone. Our native forests are almost destroyed by fire or for paper and profit, but their huge and ancient architecture exists underneath the surface of the soil still. The series of forms and processes that have shaped the landscapes that we live in today can only be imagined in our mind's eye, but perhaps this is a healthy exercise. I invite you to look with new eyes at the landscape that surrounds you. See it not as static, but as dynamic, always changing and being reshaped by many relationships. When you look out onto the mass of clear-cut agricultural lands that make up a large part of the Australian landscape, see that the grasslands and the forests that once were, the stones that eroded sediment to soils, and the rivers and seas that carried them there. This is the creation energy that gives us breath, and through this experience, we are awakened to our place and relationship with the land that shapes us. At the same time, we shape it with every step that connects to its surface. Acknowledging our connection to country can be painful because we realize that the trauma we commit to country, we also commit to ourselves. This can invoke a sense of helplessness. However, the sensation is also nurturing, and it provides a sense of belonging to place in our Great Mother. This coming home to our place initiates a sense of responsibility to care for and protect that which we are part of. Perhaps the shift in perspective is the thing that is needed to address the social, community, environmental and health issues that are impacting us all on this earth. Yeah, so I just felt that was a very beautiful way to think about our relationship and the grief, but also that sense of hopelessness and how we can reimagine who we are and how we are in a way that's really positive going forward.